meeting will come to order. Would somebody move?
Have somebody with authority here.
Somebody move Representative Huntley's 3391 bill?
I'll move it.
Representative Thielen moves the 3391, and where does this go, Representative Huntley?
The Commerce Committee.
To the Commerce Committee. Is there anything that doesn't go there? Finally, there's two parts of my recollection. Article 4, the data privacy, and, oh, it's all Article 4, the liability immunity. That's the only reason it's here, so would you go ahead and present your bill? There's no amendments, right?
No, not
okay.
This is a healthcare reform bill. It's what grew out of the governor's healthcare transformation task force and also the legislative commission on healthcare access. It's an attempt to reform the healthcare system, make it more cost effective. I'd like to say it's not controversial, but everything in it is controversial. And as far as this committee is concerned, the first thing I'll talk about is the data privacy.
Somebody's got their cell phone on. Please turn it off. It's wrecking our recording system.
And the first one is the data privacy. That's on Article 4, Sections 1 and 19. And that relates to something in the bill called the Health Insurance Exchange, which is a governor's proposal, and that would allow individuals to purchase health insurance through this exchange. And if there's a public subsidy...
Well, just a second. Somebody still has their cell phone on. Would you please turn it off? Okay, I'll get the phone. Hopefully. Go ahead, I'm sorry, Representative.
Part of the overall thrust is that people below 300% of poverty will get on a sliding fee scale a subsidy for their health insurance. And if they buy their insurance through the exchange, then the exchange needs to know what they're doing in Minnesota. Primarily talking about people in Minnesota care, so that the income information Minnesota care has would be given to the exchange, so the exchange can then subsidize these people if they choose to buy private insurance through the exchange. The bill says that all federal requirements on data privacy must be met, and the only information that would really need to be transferred is are they eligible for Minnesota care, what's their income, and what would their subsidy be.
Okay, and then could you describe the immunity part quickly?
As part of this, we're setting up this exchange, which would, by the way, the exchange is voluntary. So if you don't want to buy your insurance through the exchange, you don't have to. It just says that the state is not liable for what the exchange does. And the second one is we're setting up in this bill a group called the Healthcare Transformation Commission, which is an outgrowth of the governor's Healthcare Transformation Task Force. And what they're going to try to do is sort of coordinate the changes in the healthcare system also getting immunity, I guess. And by the way, there's a memo here from Tom Pender who itemized all these things. Article 4, Section 10, Subdivision 1 relates to a group that will answer to the Healthcare Transformation Commission. That's called the Health Technology Assessment Committee, and they are to make recommendations to the Transformation Commission about any new high-tech kinds of things that are very expensive in the healthcare industry and whether there's a cost-benefit analysis. That is also controversial, and I'm not sure it will survive. But. And the last one is relates to a health benefit set and design advisory committee. And in the exchange, the health insurance products that are going to be sold will be relatively limited in number. Any insurer that wants to sell them through there can do that. But we're going to try to, instead of having 1,000 different products, each insurance company might have 3 or 4. And so that the public can easily look at the 4. And so that means you have to have a sort of a benefit set that everybody will use in that. And then this group will make recommendations again to the Healthcare Transformation Commission. And ultimately, they will make a decision on the benefit set. Now, there's a lot of talk about the benefits that everybody gets all kinds of ideas. And most of the discussion won't be on which, if we can cover cancer of your left kidney, but not your right kidney. There, most of what they're going to be talking about is what are the co-pays, what are the deductibles, what are the co-insurance, what's the maximum out of pocket that that individual would have to pay. So that's what the focus there is going to be.
Okay. Representative Simon, did you see any problems with this on the data privacy? I just don't see Representative Holberg. Has she communicated anything, Mr. Verdon? No? Okay. Okay, is there anybody that wants to testify on this? I guess Twyla Grace. Franklin Newell and Mr. Neumeister, is that it? And which part of it? Is it the immunity or the data privacy?
Mr. Chair, I would raise President of Citizens Council on Healthcare, and it is both.
It's both? Okay. And I don't know, Mr. Newell, go ahead. We'll give each of you about 2 minutes.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Again, Twyla Brace, President of Citizens Council on Healthcare. And our concern, I'll just tackle the immunity section first, which is that the interesting thing about the exchange is that there's supposedly $9 million to set the thing up, and then we'll all be taxed for it through our insurance premiums, and then the state becomes not liable for it. There are 3 commissioners who will be on it, and then about 8 appointees, none of which, of course, are elected by anyone, but their actions will make determinations about what kind of insurance that we have and how it will run. There is a piece in there having to do with that they'll be able to make rules, but there's nothing in there that says that they have to follow Chapter 14 so that there's any ability for the public to comment or oppose the rules. And then if you look at the commissions and the advisory committees, they are also exempt or immune from liability. And so these are also people who have not been elected and are making decisions about what kind of policies we'll have, what kind of, for the technology, what kind of perhaps medications will be available and those that will not be available. And so that's our concern about the exemptions from immunity and the state not being liable. It seems that there's not a lot of public accountability and a lot of rules and decisions will be made that legislators never had any part of and elected officials never had any part of. The other piece has to do with data practices, and if you look through the bill, there's an inordinate amount of data collection happening, all of it without patient consent. I think it's the value organization, or maybe that's the Senate bill, I could be wrong about that, but the payment reform piece of it requires data to be collected on what happens between the patient and the doctor. and essentially allows the payments to be made according to what somebody outside the exam room thinks is good medical practice or is quality and efficiency. Those terms, quality and efficiency, aren't even defined. Entities outside the legislature, outside the rule of law, will decide what quality and efficiency are, and those determinations about payment or penalties will thus be made on that basis. So the data will be collected, and patients have no right to say otherwise. So those would be our concerns.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. I just went over a few seconds. Mr. Neumeister?
Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Mr. Neumeister. I'll start on page 26. Line 18 through 25. Well, for the record, my name is Rich Neumeister. It's who, what, where. What kinds of specific data, where is it going, what, I mean, those I think are important questions to be asked rather than broad exemptions or under 30, which is highlighted here. And we'll go on to the next page on page 32. Lines 30 on page 32. Representative Huntley, Mr. Chairman, made reference to HIPAA, and I don't see where HIPAA applies somehow into the Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange. We also have other laws, like state laws, and I'm interested to know, because this Minnesota Health Insurance Exchange is now a non-entity of government, as much as I've been able to read. So what laws apply to how the data is going to be regulated and accountability? Secondly, to echo Ms. Grace's point of view, there is no accountability, particularly in the areas, and it's not clear to me whether these appointments would be under the open appointment process, where people can apply, or that who you know. And sometimes that happens in some committees and all that, and I think it's important that it come under the open appointments process. I do have concerns about the liability on page 35, lines 19 and 20, that talk about they're immune, particularly what the kinds of data, which I don't know yet specifically, that's being collected. And then, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, we all are aware of lots of data breaches that have even been happening nationally, but also even in our own state over the last couple of years. On page 40, on lines 16 through 18, as an example, is collect data, how detailed, you know, what is that? And on page 41, again, where there is exemption from the Administrative Procedures Act, which is lines 16 through 24, about rules, particularly dealing with the Health Transformation Committee. And my last comment would be on section 19, which Representative Huntley did talk about. Again, a little bit more, what is it about? I would encourage, if this bill goes forward, that you be as specific as you can as to what kinds of data is being shared. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, specific, I can't say it because I had some teeth pulled recently. Specificity is important on data issues. Secondly, though, I think there needs to be a little bit more work on the accountability and transparency of some of these things and what laws, if some of these entities will come under open meeting laws, if they will come under Chapter 13, and those kinds of things like that. So, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, those are my comments.
Thank you, Mr. Neumeister. Is there a Franklin Newell? Okay. Mr. Huntley, do you want, or Representative Huntley, do you want to make a real quick comment to those points?
Number one, on page 41, subdivision 7, it talks about rulemaking exemption from administrative procedures. That's what the title is. The title is probably not correct because the sentence after it says that they have to follow the rules of...
Also, yeah, Representative Huntley, that belongs in Representative Pulowski's committee.
Yeah, she passed yesterday.
Not here. So if he was okay with it, I'm sure that...
as far as the rules, they, as I just said, they will have to follow the regular rules process. And
that's again in his committee.
Yeah, and in terms of the... Brace talked about an additional premium that's only paid by people that buy their insurance through the exchange, and they don't have to buy it through the exchange, they can buy it from somebody else.
Is there any questions from members? proceed. Okay, then all in favor of the bill and be passed with recommendation and re-referred to Commerce.
Correct.
Okay. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Members, we're sitting in House File 3483, Chairman Mulery's bill. I believe we're looking at the consent calendar with this bill. Representative Cornish, would you be willing to move House File 3483?
Yes, I'll move the bill.
Representative Cornish moves House File 3483. And Mr. Chair, Chair Mulery, I understand that we have an amendment, a DE1 amendment, is that correct?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Would you like to move that amendment?
Yes, I would. Which one?
The DE1, House 834-83 DE1. Dated March 5th, 4:29 p.m.
I'll move.
Chair Mulery, just here. Okay. Chair Mulery, if you could take a moment just to quickly review that amendment to make sure it's what you intend.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, Mr. Chairman.
Chair Mulery renews his motion to adopt the DE1 amendment. He gets the bill in the shape you would like it. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? Motion prevails. The amendment's adopted. To your bill, as amended, Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chairman, the purpose of this is just so that it's clear that an officer whose formal statement is being taken, that he can have both a union representative and an attorney there. That it right now it says or, so I think several jurisdictions already interpret it as meaning it. I think this just clarifies what many want to do. And we have Mr. Jim Michaels, attorney representing the Police Federation of Minneapolis, I believe. And is anybody else testifying? John Delmonico, the president of the Federation, would also be testifying.
Great. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Michaels. You can say your name for the record and present your testimony as concisely as possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Michaels. I'm an attorney practicing labor law. Most of my practice is representing police officers and the unions that represent them also. With me today is John Delmonico, president of the Police Federation of Minneapolis. I am also, that is one of my clients that I represent. I have seen over the years, since the Peace Officers Bill of Rights was first enacted in 1990, a growing interest and scrutiny in the conduct of police officers, which has in turn led to greater scrutiny by their departments through internal investigations and also other agencies, civil rights departments, courts, through lawsuits, on and on. many departments in Minneapolis has been one that has allowed an officer on their request, notwithstanding the language of the law as it currently exists, to have their an attorney and a union representative present during the statement. But I have also seen other agencies where they do not allow it, and they force the officer to choose. One of the problems with this is that it's important for the union to have a role in an investigatory interview, because ultimately the outcome of something it would be disciplined, if any. Obviously, if it's found that the officer did not commit misconduct, there wouldn't be any. And under labor agreements and PELRA, the right to grieve discipline is really belonging to the union, not the individual officer. So it's important for the union to be involved. There are many situations that do arise where the same set of circumstances which give rise to the internal affairs investigation might also be the subject of a criminal action, a veteran's preference hearing, a civil action against the officer in his or her department, in which case many times the officer has already retained his or her own attorney. And so the reason that we're seeking this amendment to the bill is to make it clear to those employers that do not allow the officer to have an attorney and their union representative present, to simply enable the officer the right to do that. And I'll be happy to entertain any questions that the committee members may have.
Any questions for Mr. Michaels? Thank you, Mr. Michaels. Mr. Delmonico, if you could approach the table. Welcome to the committee. State your name to the record. Present your testimony as concisely as possible. Thank you.
I'm John Delmonico, president of the Minneapolis Police Federation.
Proceed, Mr. Delmonico. Thank
Short
you.
And sweet, to reiterate what Mr. Michael says, police investigations can be very complex. They can be internal, they can be criminal, they can be civil, they can be the post board, and it is our job as early as we can to make sure the cop has the right representation. And by passing this bill would give cops the option to have the best possible representation.
Excellent. Thank you, and well stated and concisely. Thank you, Mr. Delmonico. Any questions, members, to Mr. Delmonico?
More witnesses.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, Representative Cornish removes his motion that House File 3483, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the consent calendar. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. The motion prevails. The bill passes.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair Mulry and Mr. DeMarco. Mr. Michael.
Mr. Chair, would you call 2787?
I will indeed. House File 2787 is the next item up for consideration by this committee. I am looking for it myself, Mr. Chair. Do you have amendments?
Mr. Chairman, yes, we do have an amendment. It's the A1 amendment. It was requested by the, I don't know if it's called the Insurance Federation or anyhow, it's the insurance company, to clear up what the intention of this bill was.
Okay. I believe that, I didn't move the bill yet. So, Chair Mulley, I assume you'd like to move House File 2787 for consideration, and then members, Chair Mulry, would you like to move the A1 amendment?
Yes,
Mr. Chairman. Okay. To get the bill in the shape the author would like it, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Those opposed, same sign. Amendment adopted. Proceed with the bill, Mr. Chairman.
Chair. This was actually, this discusses the private right of action under the law, and back in the 80s I used to do consumer law and handled several of these cases, and it was always the intent that it would apply to individuals. 325F.69 and then 325D, I think it's around 44 or something like that, I'm not sure, were the main ones that I was involved with. And then all of a sudden along came a court case and was interpreted according to what everybody always thought. Nobody had ever suggested before that in any case that I heard of, through appellate cases, et cetera, on individuals.
and they all of a sudden said you almost basically have to have a class action, which has actually resulted in a lot of class actions which weren't even necessary. So this is just to clear up what everyone's understanding of the law was for something like 20-some years, I believe, before that court case. And we have here University of Minnesota Law Professor Prentice Cox to speak on this.
Excellent. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Cox. And before you begin, I just want to congratulate you on your fine job dealing with the appellate court of the reporters yesterday on our foreclosure press conference. It was one of the most amiable yet contentious press conferences I've been to. You did a fine job. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Cox. State your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Mallory Prentice Cox, Associate Professor of Clinical Law at the University of Minnesota Law School. I'm usually not that ornery, by the way.
Welcome, Mr. Cox.
Representative Mallory laid out what the origin of the bill before you is. Prior to 2000, and a Supreme Court decision called Lee v. Nystrom, individuals routinely used the Consumer Fraud Act, the False Statement and Advertising Act, and other consumer protection laws, and brought suits under the private attorney general authority to do so. Farmers sued for problems with elevators, individuals, homeowners sued for problems with garage kits. These are just appellate decisions, and it was routinely used that way. In 2000, the Supreme Court imposed what they termed the public benefit test in order to have access to the court to bring one of these claims. The result of that test has been rather dramatic. The way it was enunciated in the decision, the plaintiff would have to establish that the conduct at issue was broadly disseminated to the public. In 2006, I published a law review article. Given the large number of attorneys here, I'm sure you've read it, but in the off chance you haven't looked at my article,
Representative Emmer, I'm sure that's why you and I did not read it, because it did have pictures.
I will real quickly note that the one person I know who's read it is the person who did a lot of the research on it, which at the time was my research assistant, now your staff, Matt Steering. He liked it. I'll summarize just 2 points from the article about what happened after this lawsuit. Matt and I essentially looked at every decision that had occurred after the Lee v. Nystrom case that involved this application of this public benefit test. And the results were absolutely uniform and surprising. Every individual, and it now numbers over 20 appellate decisions or reported district court decisions, every individual who's attempted to bring a case under this, under the public, since the Lee v. Nystrom case under the public benefit test, has had their action dismissed by the court for failure to meet the public benefit test. What that essentially means is that the Consumer Fraud Act and Minnesota's consumer protection laws are no longer available to individuals. Because the test is whether the conduct was broadly disseminated, and the court also held that businesses had the right to bring an action, it has had a perverse effect of making it possible for one business suing another for false advertising to use the Consumer Fraud Act, but a consumer suing a business or another individual has no right to bring an act to vindicate his or her rights. The second point I'd like to make is that after the test was passed and essentially resulted in the elimination of individuals' rights to use the private attorney general statute, the courts, and in particular the federal courts, have extended this doctrine to what I would consider to be fairly pernicious result. And an example would be, there's now a line of court decisions saying that even if there was a public benefit when you sued, if the company has claimed to have ceased the conduct since the time your action arose, then there's no public benefit So even if you had damages and the conduct was broadly disseminated at that time, if they claim to have ceased the conduct, you still have no right to bring an action under the Consumer Fraud Act. For those reasons, I hope that the committee would consider going back to the state of the law prior to 2000, which is the purpose.
Thank you, Mr. Cox. Your brothers could testify in the bill.
And I also,
Mr. Chairman,
my understanding is not just individuals, that maybe a contractor's only had 12 people that he worked with, and that might not meet the court standards.
Mr. Cox.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mallory, that's correct. It gets ambiguous when it goes past an individual. There have been cases going both ways, but it calls into question anything short of a class action gets called into question.
Thank you, Mr. Cox.
Mr. Chairman,
Chair Mallory.
And Mr. Slade.
Welcome to the committee, sir. Please state your name for the record. Proceed with your testimony as concisely as possible.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you. My name is Galen Robinson. I'm a litigation director with Mid-Minnesota Legal Assistance. Our program only represents low-income individuals in civil actions. We are one of seven programs in the state. What's important about this bill is prior to 2000, low-income individuals who were deceived could bring an independent action and get relief for the deceptive practice. After the court case, they no longer can, unless you have a class action. The problem with that is, one, class actions aren't a very efficient way to resolve most individual consumer disputes. I've done some. They take years. They aren't a good way to resolve an individual case. Second part of the problem with that is, most legal services programs representing low-income individuals are not permitted to bring class actions. I'm not advocating for class actions, but the bottom line is, all of the clients they represent have no relief whatsoever in the state under the current status of the bill. Just a couple of quick examples how this would affect clients we have. We had one client who only speaks Spanish, went to a car dealer, was told, here are the terms of this contract you're signing. The contract was exactly the opposite. A consumer fraud claim ought to be able to redress that person's problem. Another quick example, a real estate agent in the mortgage foreclosure crisis promised to buy someone's house and satisfy the mortgage, give it back to them later on. The paperwork permitted them to buy the house without paying anything. Our client remained liable on the mortgage. His credit's ruined. He doesn't have the house. And he also can't bring a consumer fraud claim against the person whose statements were exactly the opposite of what he put in writing. Prior to the change in this bill, there were not very many cases brought, and we don't see them that often. But when you do have a predatory deceptive practice, it's critical that an individual consumer should be able to address that in the court. So we'd encourage you to pass this.
Thank you, Mr. Robinson. I believe Mr. Robinson, Representative Cole,
can
you
wait? Well, I can wait until the last one.
Appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Nicholas Slade. I'm with Berry & Slade. We're a private consumer rights law firm.
Welcome to the committee, Mr. Slade. Please proceed with your testimony as concisely as possible.
I will do that. I want to pick up on a couple of quick things. Firstly, the class action, one of the problems by limiting the Consumer Fraud Act to class actions, which is what this is effectively, Levy-Tyson decision effectively did, is it does mean you have to bring a class action, but oftentimes you don't. When an individual comes to us, that person's circumstances are such that it's too individual a set of circumstances to support a class action. So the individual has to have their own, you have to be able to bring their own right of action. And oftentimes when they come to us and we start explaining to them the cost of litigation and support, that'll turn them off. And the ironic thing about that is an enormous number of people who call us are actually people who have first gone to the Attorney General's office, gone through their Consumer Affairs Bureau, and the Attorney General will tell them, yes, you've got a problem, but because your problem is that of only you as an individual, the Attorney General's office can't represent them. until they say, well, you need to go out and find private attorneys and everything. Well, they come to us and they say, well, we'd love to help you, but it's going to cost you a lot of money. And so it's effectively removed all consumer fraud action out of the state system. So for that reason, I would strongly urge that this matter be status quo be turned back and decreed by the United States.
Thank you, Mr. Slade. Questions from members? Representative Cole, if you do have a testifier in opposition to the bill, would you like to ask a question now?
If I could, Mr. Chair.
Proceed, Representative Cole.
Mr. Chair, Representative Mallory, one of the witnesses, I understand the argument that you're making with regard to the consumer fraud statute. However, doesn't an individual, and the examples that you gave, sir, I don't recall your name, but the examples you gave, wouldn't an individual have a claim for common law fraud, either in state district court or, depending on the amount of controversy, the potential to bring a claim in conciliation court?
I can certainly
explain.
The thing about consumer fraud, one of the other important things is that it allows for the recovery of attorney fees. If you have a regular common law fraud case, because of the way the American system works, unless you have a specific contract or statutory right to attorney's fees, you can't recover them. So if the amount of fraud is actually fairly small, which oftentimes it can be, there's no way that a person can afford to, if they've been defrauded out of perhaps $1,000, the cost of litigation is going to far exceed that. The other problem with common law fraud is it's a much more complex set of facts to prove. The level of intent is much higher and far more difficult to prove that you've been defrauded. It takes some knowledge on the part of the scammer that they have to be able to prove that they were truly intentionally trying to scam you. And so it's a much more difficult, plus you don't have the right to recover your attorney's fees to cover the cost of litigation.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Cole.
Mr. Chairman, I understand the difference between common law fraud and a statutory consumer fraud claim, but that doesn't answer my question. My question was, you still have a remedy, at least a potential remedy, that you can pursue by bringing a common law fraud case either in district court or in conciliation court, depending on the amount of controversy. Is that not correct? I understand you can't get attorney's fees, but that wasn't my question. My question was, does an individual have the ability to bring a claim?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Paul, clearly not in many cases, because all of the elements necessary to prove common law fraud aren't necessarily provable, and you don't have the evidence of it. And I really don't see why it should harm. If Attorney General can bring a consumer law fraud case, why can't an individual? Why would we prevent individuals from having that right? I just don't understand it.
I do believe that Dave Diedrichs, oh, there you are, couldn't see you for a second. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Diedrichs. Please state your name for the record, proceed as concisely as possible.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I will be concise. For the record, my name is Dave Diedrichs, the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. Thanks for the opportunity to come speak to you regarding this bill. I am here in somewhat of a pinching matter, so I will be brief. The Chamber is, and many of our members are particularly concerned about this legislation. Not only are our members of the opinion that this legislation would lead to increased litigation, perhaps more importantly, they're also very concerned that there's a substantial likelihood that there would be an increase in implied private rights of action across the entire scope of Minnesota law. In fact, I was just out in the hallway before this bill came up, and I was looking at the different areas of Minnesota law that could be affected by this, and I just wrote down the first 9 out of over 3 pages of listings. Employment, cable communications, arts, fine print, beer brewers, wholesalers, all applications that are the Uniform Trade Secrets Act, Minnesota Unfair Cigarette Sales Act, Deceptive Trade Practices Act, unlawful gambling, retail merchandise, unlawful gasoline sales. So it is very broad, this application. Now, in all fairness, I should state that I have had several conversations today with Mr. Elwood from Legal Aid, and he understands our concern about the broad scope of this bill, and he said he'd be interested in talking to us about narrowing its application. We can't make any promises, but we're very concerned about this bill and its current condition. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'll conclude my testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Diedrichs. And I'd like to start just with a quick question for Chair Mullery, whether he knew that he's aware that the bill actually did indeed hit beer brewers. I have great concern.
Mr. Chairman, there is a new beer brewer right outside of my district, a few blocks, and it's supposed to be the best in the state, so according to the newspaper. So I was not aware that we were going after beer brewers, and I'm not sure that all those listed are really the qualify for the treatment here. I don't think that. I really don't think that those are all within the scope of what's intended by the chapter.
Thank you, Chair Miller, and I want to thank Mr. Diedrichs. He and I had a brief conversation earlier today about the Chamber's concerns and appreciate your willingness to work out some of those issues with Legal Aid and hope that we can clarify some intent. Chair Miller.
I also heard from some members here that they got calls from their businesses and wanted it because they were they thought it'd be good at stopping the class actions they've been hit with, because people, if they can't sue as an individual, they start looking for people and start a class action, which wouldn't have occurred otherwise.
Mr. Chairman, what's the motion here? Is this going to the floor, or is it going to Chair Paymark's committee?
I was just going to ask that. I believe we're going to the general register. Is that correct, Chair Mullery? Representative Cole.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mullery, we're creating or reinstating, depending on your perspective, causes of action that didn't exist before. I mean, the Supreme Court has said you can't bring these, and now we're saying, yeah, you can. How is that not going to have fiscal implications for a state court? We have cases that before couldn't be brought, and now whether you're of the belief that it's going to open the floodgates to all kinds of litigation, or it's going to be less. I mean, isn't there a fiscal issue here that that needs to be at least considered?
Mr. Chairman, I don't think there is on this type of a case. There was not a lot of cases before for the 20 years that are more than 24 or 25 or 24 years that it was in existence before.
27, I think your phone friend was saying.
I can't do math. Sorry. 27 years, okay.
Chairman Mullery, I would just note, I've had bills before this committee in my 6 years here in the legislature. I can think specifically of my legislation regarding the seatbelt gag rule that currently precludes the use of seatbelt evidence in civil trials. And there was a fiscal note put on that bill, and I believe there was a bill last year that I can't remember if it was Representative Atkins' bill or another bill, where we were creating, essentially opening up the courts to a new cause of action, and there was a fiscal note put on that bill. So Mr. Chair, at the appropriate time, I will be making the motion to send it to make the recommendation be that the bill go to Chairman Paymark's committee. But if
there's no other question,
Chairman, basically, I don't think so, but we have the answer sitting over here to the right. He wants to see it or doesn't see it. Doesn't matter. He decides.
Representative Paymark, do you have any thoughts on the issue?
I hear yourself.
No.
In this case, he's a judge and jury all combined.
Representative Paymark?
Mr. Chairman, in any event, I guess whether we send it to the floor now or not, I'll be making a request through Mr. Carter to have a fiscal note put that on.
Thank you, sir. Representative Tamar.
If there's not a problem, why don't we just do that and avoid any conflict and have an informal
Mr. Chairman,
I have no objection.
Mr. Chairman, that's great. I mean, maybe there won't be a cost, and then we can just take it right out of Chair Paymar's committee if that's the direction this is going to go. I think I know where the votes are going to line up on this, but I think we should still take a look at the potential fiscal implications.
Representative Kroll said, just to warn you, Representative Bingham is not feeling well today, so I wouldn't be too sure about where votes might line up, but we're hoping that people are willing to stay with us.
I have my coat.
Oh, good. I guess you're feeling better. So. Chair Mueller, hearing consent, I want to double check with Representative Paymar that we can amend your motion to
Send it to finance
for the further recommendation. Thank you, Chair Mulry, for being able to work that way, and I believe then we'll also be working on a little committee deadline in terms of delaying the bill by sending it along to another committee. So, any further questions from members? Seeing none, Representative Mulry renews his motion that House File 2787, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to the Committee on Finance with a further recommendation that it be sent to Public Safety Finance. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All opposed, same sign?
No.
The motion prevails and it passes. Thank you, Chair Mulry.
Mr. Chairman, to bring up the other one, it was also very quick, but it's already
Chair Mulry, I believe the bill you're referring to is House File 3598.
I think it's just correcting the mistakes of the committee.
Chair Mulley, would you like to move House File 3598 and bring the bill before us?
Yes, Mr. Chairman.
So moved. And I see that there's a technical amendment. Members, the A1 amendment, Representative Mulley moves the A1 amendment. It is an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape you'd like it. Seeing no objections, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendment adopted.
Mr. Chairman, members, this bill just reenacts the provision of Minnesota's criminal sexual conduct statutes that was initially enacted in 1975 and repealed by mistake in 2005 when the legislature created new mandatory sentencing provisions for sex offenders. It seems that it was unintentional, and this just reinstates the repeal language. We can provide for a 36-month mandatory presumptive sentencing for offenders for first through fourth degree criminal sexual conduct and criminal predatory sexual conduct when the offender has been convicted of similar conduct within 3 to 15 years. And we have from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission, and I believe that Representative Smith would probably know the intent of the bill that came out of the committee. I think this is the
Chair Mulry, let's hear from Ms. Wall first. If you have anything, I assume you have testimony to provide briefly, and then we'll go to Representative Smith and then also, I believe, Representative Western. So, welcome to committee, Ms. Wall. Please identify yourself for the record. Present your testimony.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Mulder, members of the committee, my name is Ann Wall, and I'm the Senior Research Analyst for the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. I'm here today because our director, Isabel Gomez, had another commitment, and she asked me to come in her place. I just wanted to explain why this is important. When the Sentencing Guidelines Commission adopted new rules for sentencing sex offenders that went into effect last August, August of 2006, I'm sorry. They thought that this provision continued to exist. In fact, this provision did exist when they developed that that new system. What they tried to do was to increase penalties for repeat sex offenders. They didn't up the penalties all across the board, because in 2005, you put in place life sentences for the most serious sex offenders. And they said, well, who's left that's really a problem? And they said, we want to make sure that we get tougher on repeat offenders. But there are provisions, there are places on the sentencing guidelines grid, even with the new rules that went into effect, where it's possible for a repeat offender to have a presumptive probation system. I believe you have a copy of the grid attached to a letter from Isabel, Isabel Gomez. And while we are increasing criminal history scores for sex offenders, and we are giving them an extra point if they commit a sex offense while on probation or supervised release for a sex offense, some of the lowest level sex offenders could still come in with a presumptive probation sentence. And we say, well, that's okay, because we have the mandatory minimum in statute that applies to all first through fourth degree offenders, so they'll be presumptive prison anyhow. The commission really intended that any repeat sex offender have a presumptive prison sentence, and in fact, that's what was happening before they even changed the provisions for sentencing sex offenders, because this provision was in statute. And I think what happened was in 2005, when the life sentences were adopted, a bunch of things got recodified so that all the sentencing enhancements for sex offenders were in one statute, and somehow this just fell by the wayside. Nobody remembers anybody thinking this was a good idea to abandon this mandatory minimum for repeat offenders provision. Most of the sentencing guidelines, presumptive sentences for the most serious sex offenders are all much greater than 36 months. The 36-month mandatory minimum is going to apply to repeat offenders that commit the lower level criminal sexual conduct offenses who somehow have managed to not do it while they're still on probation or on supervised release for a previous offense. And that's why it's important to reinstate it.
Thank you, Ms. Wall. Representative Smith?
Mr. Chairman, could I ask a clarifying question? Did the change that occurred that you're referring to have the effect of decreasing sentences?
Ms. Wall?
For a few offenders a year. I looked in 2005 and 2006, and in both years there were two repeat sex offender sentences that had presumptive probation sentences rather than presumptive prison sentences, who would have had a presumptive prison sentence before this law was repealed.
So, Mr. Chairman, then the answer to my question is yes, that it had the effect of decreasing sentences. Mr. Chairman, I won't add or detract to the testimony, but as I recall, our intent, the intent at the time was to not do that, not to decrease.
Representative Smith is an outsider looking into the legislature at the time. That's certainly what I think the public's perception was of the changes that were made as well. Representative Weston, have you got a question?
Chair, to the witness, Representative Mulley, explain to me, crim sex 1 through 4, a minimum 36-month sentence, why do we have such a broad category, so many categories with all part of a 36-month minimum? Doesn't it seem like some of the higher, as I recall, crim sex 1 is worse than crim sex 4, wouldn't we want a higher minimum on the
It doesn't, Mrs. Smith, thank you. It doesn't apply to crim sex 1 because the presumptive sentence for all of those offenders is 144 months. So it really only comes into play when the presumptive sentence for an offense is less than 36 months, and that's a limited number of sex offenses and a limited criminal history scores. So that's the way the statute was written since 1975, but for all practical matters, it does not apply to crim sex offenses and the more severe second and third degree offenses, because their presumptive sentences are all much greater than 36 months.
Any other questions from members? Anyone in the audience wish to testify for or against the bill? Seeing none, Representative Mulley moves his motion that House File 3598, as amended, be recommended to pass, be referred to finance, and with a further recommendation to re-refer to public safety finance. So all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Bill is passed. And the next stop will be House File 2996, and Chair Mullery will resume the gavel.
Representative Tamer, I assume you moved your House File 2996. Is there any amendment to it?
Yes, Mr. Chair, there is. I'd like to move the A1 amendment.
Representative Tamer, I move the A1 amendment to get it in the shape you want, the author wants it in. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. 3-0.
Okay, well.
Representative Tamer, go ahead and present the bill.
Mr. Chair, Representative Eastland and I are going to present the bill. I know that we're pressed for time, so it will be as brief as possible. We have three testifiers to really outline the bill. That'll only take a couple of minutes.
Thank you.
Let me just say, Mr. Chair, members, this bill came out of a lot of meetings. We had a reentry, offender reentry working group, and there were county attorneys were part of this, probation officers, public defenders, the Department of Corrections, etc. And the whole idea behind this bill was that. The fact of the matter that 95% of all incarcerated inmates will be released from prison, and our concern has been that these ex-offenders are going to be coming back to our communities and our neighborhoods. So our goal was first and foremost public safety, secondly examining the barriers to effective reintegration of ex-offenders, and looking at the drug offenses that have caused such a spike in incarceration in our prisons and our current reentry efforts. So that's what we did. We had some great discussion, and I think we have a good bill that, I'm not going to say more at this point.
Thank you, Mr.
Chair.
Representative
Eastland. I'm Representative Eastland, and I'm supporting this bill. I just want to give you a little reason why. I've been on the public safety committee for 6 years. This is my sixth year. And when I first got on the committee, what we were talking about was overcrowded prisons, and we were trying to get bonding bills passed for Faribault. We were talking about privatizing and Appleton and all that sort of thing. We had a population of about 7,000 at the time, and today we have a population of over 9,000. So our prison population is growing. And as Representative Paymar said, 95% of people in prison eventually come home when their sentences are done. Right now, according to corrections, we release about 6,000 inmates a year who have served their time. And one of the things that's really striking to me is that 35% of those released reoffend within 3 years, and 25% of those released end up coming back for additional prison time. And it seems to me that when we're looking at overcrowded prisons, that one of the most efficient ways to try and stop that would be to stop the revolving door and figure out a way how prisoners, when they leave prison, won't be condemned just to reoffend. And I think one of the things that we have done poorly in our prison system is release. At the time I got on the committee, our release policy was they got some treatment and a few things just before they left, and they got $100 and a bus ride. And so the chances of somebody that had no support outside of the prison system to succeed were very, 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 very small. One of the things our prison or our correction system is good at is incarceration. What we do is we incarcerate, and I kind of equate that with punishment. We don't do a lot of rehabilitation for corrections, but yet we call it the Department of Corrections. And so I think this would complete the picture. We have a good system. We know how to catch people. We know how to convict them of crimes. We know how to put them in jail. But we also need to learn more effectively how to release them so that they have a better chance of succeeding. And so that's what this bill is about. That's why I support it. I think it's the best policy that we could have to make our correction system complete.
Mr. Chair.
Hey, Mary,
The witnesses, Representative Eastland and I chaired this interim meeting, this working group over the interim. And just to, I'd like Mr. Stewart to come up and talk about section one of the bill. Rather than having me go through every section, I think maybe just highlight a few pieces that members may have questions about.
It's a good idea, Representative Tamar, and then if somebody asks a question on something else, we can take it up.
So, Mr. Stewart, do you want to come up and address briefly section one of the bill?
Stewart?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is John Stewart. I'm the State Public Defender. Section one of the bill deals with Minnesota Statute 15218. And basically, it addresses this problem. You might know of people in your hometown that have faced this situation among your constituents. Somebody is arrested for a low-level, nonviolent drug possession crime. Very small amounts involved. Somebody who has never had a drug crime conviction previously. The question is, will this person have a chance to have an incentive of a clean record if they clear up their drug problem and follow the conditions that are set by the court? Now, here's the problem. Some counties have three different ways to address this situation. Some of you are from counties that have a drug court. Some of these folks go through drug court. Some of you are from counties that have a drug diversion program. And some counties use 15218 quite a bit. There are some small counties that use it on perhaps as many as half to two-thirds of their fourth and fifth degree drug possession cases. But it's really a matter of justice by geography, because there are places in the state that just don't think about this, that just don't reference 15218 very often. This section one of this bill creates a presumption that for this low-level, nonviolent, drug possession, first-time guy, that the court would look at 15218 as a presumed disposition. If the person meets that set of conditions, they should have the opportunity to clean up their problem and do what the court says, and then they might not have that felony drug conviction. We hear from a lot of people that if you have that felony conviction on your record, even if you're 19 years old and you had a very small quantity of drugs, that you can kind of forget about a job or forget about getting a place to live. So this is to give these people a chance in the counties that don't have a drug court or don't have a diversion program. By the way, you have to plead guilty or be found guilty in order to get this disposition. And if you don't do what you're supposed to do, then you go back to court and you receive the regular sentence just like anybody else. You certainly don't get the benefit in that kind of case.
That would be section one. Representative Tamar, do you have
that's basically it on section one. If there's any questions,
does anybody have questions on section one? You have to raise your
hand. Would you prefer to hold all questions until after the testimony? Because I just have a question.
I think for all the witnesses up there, probably rather than bringing them back.
My question is, how does this differ, or how would the sentence and the outcome change in different to a drug court like Hennepin County or Ramsey County has? Because, I'm not a lawyer, but my understanding of the Hennepin County Drug Court is that there's a screening process. They kind of have requirements that you make, and you're in it. You don't make them, you go into the normal court side of things instead of the drug court. How would this differ from that, and how would it affect it, in general, because it's a statewide thing. So how would this affect the drug courts that we have now and are planning to have in the future?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Bigham, this
statute doesn't require all the resources that you need to have a drug court. In a drug court, you have meetings maybe once a week, maybe once every 2 weeks, where the offender comes before the judge and has a meeting with the drug court team, that has a prosecutor and so on. But we've only been able to afford to site about 18 adult drug courts around the state. In Hennepin County, they use 15218 as one of the tools for some of the cases in drug court. But you don't need to have a drug court in order to use this statute. You can have the judge order regular UAs, serve some time in jail, pay a fine, do community service. The thing that the person gets that is like the drug court, the common element, is that if you do all the things you're supposed to do and you stay clean, you have a chance to keep a clean record. That.
Yes. Oh, Representative Lash. Thank you. This is Stuart. Now, this, under 15218, this applies only to prior drug crimes, right? So if you got something else, like a prior robbery or something else, that's kind of glossed over.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lash, you don't have to give 15218s under this bill if there's a reason stated not to. And of course, if the person has a prior robbery conviction, there's no point in letting them keep a clean felony record. I would assume that you and the court wouldn't allow that, because that's a person who's committed a violent crime, they already have a felony record. This is for the kind of person that gets caught with a small amount of dope. That's the best way I can explain it. It's not for a person who's identified in a criminal lifestyle committing robberies and so on.
And I understand that, but the effect of this does make it a little more onerous for the judge then, right, who has to make specific findings to determine that. Is that true?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, yes, but in the hypothetical case, it would be a pretty short specific finding. They'd say, this guy's a robber, and he wouldn't get it.
I represent him. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've spoken a few times in this committee about how I think we're not adequately dealing with technical violations and nonviolent drug offenders, and I know that our county jails are just fogged with folks who made mistakes and we're teaching them how to be better criminals, not actually ending the cycle. And the recidivism rate is phenomenal, and it's breaking the bank, and I think it's one of the things that's driving up property taxes and driving up the state budget. And I hope that Representative Amar will have a deeper discussion about whether we can do some things about the state, about the budget deficit, as we're looking to make cuts and long-term savings here. Which leads to my question, actually looking at on line 2.13 of the bill, first time I've had this experience of looking at actually the word after the new language, which is permissive language about treatment programs or education programs. Right now it's discretionary. And I'm wondering if Mr. Stewart or Representative Tamar, Representative Eastman, if he's still in the room, I don't see, but whether you might speak to the choice to keep it discretionary rather than mandatory. Granting a deferral seems like that's the best chance to say, look, you screwed up, you messed up once. Maybe let's teach you some tools to actually get back on that productive cycle of life.
Representative
Kalin. Mr. Chair, Representative Kalin, I think that's a good point. I guess this statute gives the judge the power to tailor the conditions of the 15218 to the individual. It's like having a judge set the conditions of probation. In some cases, the person may need treatment, they may need drug education, they may need to go to jail for a while, they may need to pay a fine. But the judge would shape that on a case-by-case basis, like a drug court judge would.
Mr. Chair, Judge Dean in my neighboring county has done a great job with staggered sentencing, and so I know that
the benefit of the sort of monitoring, you know, of the discretion and the monitoring, the accountability, and the success it can have, but I'm not sold on whether, on where, in what case granting a deferral and not sending to a program already in law, what the benefit is. I mean, I understand the flexibility, but I think that if you're granting a deferral, I don't think it's unreasonable. I don't know if Representative Tamar might be able to chime in. Unreasonable to say that a condition of deferral, even the flexibility, is that you need to be given more tools to get on a productive path.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kayla, well, these people would have a Rule 25 assessment for chemical dependency, and that would make a lot of difference. You might have a person who is an addict that would come in, and what they would need would be inpatient treatment. You might have another person that would come in and they're just a dabbler and they're assessed as having abused substances occasionally. So it would give the court the power to craft the appropriate disposition for each one.
Mr. Chair, I'm not told Ms. Stewart yet, but I appreciate that.
Mr. Chair, if I may, there would be a probation officer involved also. The court would receive a report. They would receive corroboration and testimony. They could order UAs. There are a lot of things the court could do to tailor this disposition.
I think for the purposes of time here, we can work on this section. I know it's controversial. I'm happy to work on this section as it moves forward.
Pretty close, and we had hoped to get in two short bills before.
And I would like, there's one other part of the bill that I really think that we really need.
Just a second, just Representative Owen, do you want to?
Has the court actually been asked their opinion of it?
Mr. Stewart, or?
Mr. Chair and Representative Olin, in another hearing, a representative of the court said that they were studying it to see if it had a fiscal impact. And I think that among the 300 individual judges around the state, you get a lot of different answers about what they would think about this.
Thank you. I'd be happy to work on this as it moves forward. I would like County Attorney Gertner, if she would come up and discuss Section 6 of the bill, which is the Certificate of Good Conduct. Gertner.
Good evening, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Susan Gertner. I'm the Ramsey County Attorney, and I would like to speak to Section 6. The Minnesota County Attorneys Association strongly supports this provision of the bill, which provides a process for an ex-offender to get a certificate of good conduct. We feel that this is really a good step in the direction of enhanced public safety. If someone can't get a job, if someone can't find a place to live, if someone can't practice their profession via a license, then what are the chances that they're going to be able to turn their lives around? Not very good. So we think it's in the best interest, again, of public safety, that there be some mechanism by which a person can get a certificate of good conduct to present to employers, to present to housing officials, and really have a process whereby they're essentially vetted by a judge through a very good process, and so that they can move on. The bottom line is that we can't expect the mere fear of going back to prison to be enough to have an offender choose a new life. We have to give them the tools to construct a new and better life, and we think this certificate of good conduct process is a good way to do so.
Representative Tamar, there's been a suggestion offered to me that your motion be changed to pass it without recommendation. Is that a problem? I think it would help get it out tonight quickly. Is there any
other part that needs more time?
Is there any other discussion or any questions on the bill? Okay, then I believe Representative Paymar changes his motion to pass without recommendation, refer it to finance with a referral suggestion to your committee, Representative Paymar. Is that correct? Okay, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Representative Thiessen, can we present your what do you think? Or is there, oh, there is? Ooh. Oh, I'm sorry. There's a lot of opposites. I'm sorry. There's a lot of opposites. Representative Shemansky, can you present your bill quickly? We're still in order. Representative Shemansky, does someone want to move? Representative Cornish moves 3217. Representative Shemansky, can you present your bill quickly?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. This bill is simply adding a couple of extra departments to the statute. Number 609.78, subdivision 1. And what we're asking for is to make it a misdemeanor to report an emergency police or fire call.
Mr. Chair, I spoke with the author of the bill, and I'm hoping, as a friendly amendment, on line 1.16, right before the word "make," to insert intentionally. There's this video going around on the internet of this little kid trying to do his math homework, and his father had always told him, if you ever have a problem, call 911. So he goes ahead and he couldn't figure out his math problem, so he called 911. And so I just don't want, I just think to put intentionally, and I know there's knowing in it, but I think to put intentionally in it would possibly just make a stronger bill.
Is there any response there, or is there anybody at all from law enforcement or county attorneys or a city attorney that's walking by the door right now? Well, I'm just Representative Lesh, I'm wondering what this might possibly do to proof of the offense. The word intentional, I'm just wondering what the Representative Lesh, I'm wondering if that'll make it a lot harder to prove an offense.
Okay, in 1.16, intentionally makes calls. Well, we've got the knowing requirement as well. Yes, I think it would make it, there's no question it would make it more difficult to prove, but remember, yeah, I think that would make a difference, Mr. Chair. I'll just say yes.
She said it makes a
difference.
And I think it's a good change.
Good change, okay. Is there any opposition to the bill? Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Bigham moves.
I thought it was a friendly amendment, Mr. Chair.
Okay,
I would move that amendment.
All in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Carries. Any further discussion on the bill? Okay, all in favor of the bill say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. Goes to the floor. Representative Cornish moves the minutes of March 3rd and March 4th. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
All opposed, no. carries. The meeting is adjourned, and we will. I don't think we. Can we recess to tomorrow?
Okay, we're coming back
tomorrow.
Got it.
We're coming back at 10 a.m. tomorrow in room 10, so I don't think we can recess.
I thought we were coming back later tonight.
The meeting is adjourned, and we will convene at 10 a.m. tomorrow in room 10. Yeah.